You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a psychologist tells us why many of our minds have gone into pandemic survival mode and how we can help shake it off. Now, in a statement about the 2020 election last weekend, former President Donald Trump falsely claimed that his vice president could have overturned the election. It's after he suggested he might pardon January 6th rioters should he become president again. Here he is at a rally in Texas on Saturday.
If I run and if I win, we will treat those people from January 6th fairly. We will treat them fairly. And if it requires pardons, we will give them pardons because they are being treated so unfairly.
This comes as reporting is shedding new light on strategies that Trump and his advisors considered and attempted in order to keep Trump in office despite his election loss. We're taking a closer look at these stories, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about the state of elected government in America? Do stories about the 2020 election and its aftermath make you worry more? Do you think we need to make changes to strengthen democratic institutions like voting and elections? What do you think as you hear more details trickling in about the days between the November 2020 election and January 6th of the next year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jeffrey Engel is a history professor and founding director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University. Jeff, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's good to talk to you.
Before we dig into some of the individual particular stories here, you've been quoted in the news saying that you're worried that the American people may be getting numb to this steady disclosure of facts, maybe not seeing the big picture and how serious it is.
I think that's true. I think that we are suffering from a couple of problems here as a nation. The first, of course, and I'm hardly the first person to say this, is our diffuse and divided media ecosystems. So if you are watching, you know, one television program, let's say MSNBC, you probably have heard a lot about the January 6th event. I like to call it insurrection. If you're watching Fox News or another right-wing media outlet, you probably are not concerned with it. You're probably more concerned with something else that they are focusing on. So we have half the population essentially hearing about a problem and half not. And then the second aspect of what makes Americans, I think, numb to this is that we've been through 5 years of a great deal of presidential news. Let's put it that way. The president was a much more active figure under the Trump administration in your personal daily lives and in your conversations, frankly, I would argue, than almost any other time in American history. So after 5 years with competing ecosystems and competing elements of news coming out constantly, there's only so many times that the American public can be shocked into action, shocked into even answering the beep on their phone that tells them there's something new. So the fact that we have something very important going on in trying to understand what happened at the end of the election, after the election, and January 6th, the fact that that's very, very important doesn't mean that Americans essentially still have the energy to keep up with the pace of events.
President Trump talked in that Texas rally about the idea of he'd wished that Vice President Pence had overturned the election. Some of the language in the past had been, at least in public, taking more time to investigate allegations of fraud. Is it significant that the O word, overturn word, came out?
You know, I actually don't think so, except in the sense that it's going to cause us to hopefully have these conversations. So I appreciate that aspect of it. But President Trump is not one to, former President Trump is not one to particularly choose his words wisely often. As we know, one of the major downfalls of his White House was his own proclivity to say things that were inappropriate or would grab headlines of the kind that he didn't want. So I don't think it's necessarily important that Trump has used the word overturn. What is significant is the amount of information that's coming out that shows that that's exactly what he designed to do. That's exactly what he wanted to do after after November of the election, when it became clear that he did not win. The number of times and different ways and different manifestations of policies designed to do just that, overthrow a duly accredited election, are astounding. There really is no precedent for it in American history. And I want to be careful when I say that, because, you know, as a historian, we always tell our students not to use the word unprecedented, because usually it just means you're not trying hard enough. If you look further, you can find something. I can't find any parallel to a president so actively rejecting the voice of the people in their national vote.
One of the particulars that's come out over the last couple of weeks has been a talk of seizing voting machines and then President Trump inquiring about that, encouraging the idea first from the Justice Department, the Defense Department, Homeland Security, trying to find an avenue to seize voting machines in especially battleground states. What are you seeing there? What do you make of those disclosures?
Again, I don't mean to be hyperbolic about it, but this is actually terrifying. This is what governments that are uninterested in being democratic or listening to the voice of the people do. They seize the ballot boxes. I'll give you a great example from American history, in a sense, which is that one of the reasons that the United States went into Panama in 1989 to depose Manuel Noriega was because he had done just that. His troops had taken all the ballot boxes. And once they're in somebody else's possession, you know, it's hard to know who's stuffing what. So you know, once you have, in essence, the government being able to determine not just who won in a freer and fair way, but essentially using force to impose its own decision-making on the ballot boxes, that's a very, very dangerous thing. That's very typical of the way that fascist organizations operate and retain power. You know, again, I hate to be use exaggerated hyperbolic words, but this is actually a rejection of democracy. And especially since we know that there were no federal statutes that would have given the president authority to do this, whether in the Justice Department or the Department of Homeland Security or the Pentagon. And if you think back on the moments in the weeks that passed after the election, one of the most significant events to my mind was the resignation of the Attorney General, William Barr. William Barr, who had done as much, if not more than anyone, to keep Trump in office during the difficult time for him of the impeachment and the Mueller investigation. And so William Barr resigned because he would not go forward with the president's desire to do just this, to push the big lie and to seize ballot boxes. So if you have perhaps the most virulent of President Trump's supporters saying, "Mr. President, I'm sorry, that goes too far," that should give pause to anyone, I think, who continues to support the former president's activities.
Talking to historian Jeffrey Engel, founding director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University, about the latest on efforts to overturn the 2020 election by President Trump and his closest colleagues. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your reactions to the latest news, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls. Mike is with us in Oconomowoc. Mike, hi.
Hi. It's a great topic. I'm a little concerned that we keep talking about this is what they wanted to do, this is what he wanted to try and do, and unsuccessfully, which there was, in reality, almost no way for it to happen. I mean, we have such divided government. This isn't a Noriega situation where the guy actually ran the military by himself. So he can't command the military to do anything. He can't command any of these other departments to do anything. He can command individuals, and most of them resigned or rebelled against him. But I think that our narrative here on this whole thing seems to be more that they're trying to prevent him from running again, which is fine with most of us who are more in the center on this country. And yet it's not doing anything legislatively to move this country forward, because there's no threat that an individual president of the United States could ever have in this country. It's almost basic civics.
Mike, thanks for the call. And Jeff, this is, a common argument. Yes, President Trump and his colleagues tried to do these things, but the Secretary of State of Georgia pushed back. The Attorney General pushed back. There were safeguards there. It didn't happen, so the system worked.
You know, I'm really glad that your caller asked this really important question. As he put it, it is basic civics, but there's a hidden step within basic civics that we don't often tell people when we teach them that in school or when we talk about these things openly. And that is that laws only work if people follow them. Chains of command only work if people follow them. As to your caller's point, there were many people who resigned rather than fulfill President Trump's desires in this instance and throughout American history. People who resign because a president has said something that they thought was illegal or unconstitutional. And the way this typically plays out is that the president keeps on firing people until he finds the guy who will do it. Most famously, actually, you know, Richard Nixon's decision to fire the special investigator of him for Watergate. He fired the first attorney general, then the second, and then finally found somebody who was willing to do that deed, which happened to be Robert Bork, hurt him for his own future in the Supreme Court. So we have to remember that we are, yes, a nation of laws, but we're also a nation of people. And if people choose to not follow the law, or to give them, to be fair, if people choose to follow the person who is in their authority chain of command, who is doing something illegal or wrong, then we have a problem. And as you mentioned, the Secretary of State of Georgia is, I think, a wonderful example of this, that, you know, we have on tape. And I don't know why this, frankly, was not enough to bring more fury down on his head, shall we say, if not legal consequences. We have the President of the United States telling the Secretary of State of Georgia that I need you to find me votes. Imagine if the Secretary of State had said yes. And it's not far-fetched to think of a Secretary of State saying yes, because there are many people running currently to be Secretary of States of their own state around the country who have basically made it their campaign promise that they would have said yes in that moment. So laws only work when good people follow them.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Jeffrey Engel, presidential historian, founding director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University, with us today to talk about some of the new information coming to light about former President Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election outcome. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the former president's interest in having voting machines seized in various states? How about the effort to put forth electors who weren't electors, including here in Wisconsin? Do you have questions about these stories? What do you think they mean for the health of our democracy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about the aftermath of the 2020 presidential election and new reporting about former President Trump's efforts to stay in power. Jeffrey Engel with Southern Methodist University stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Jeff, before we go back to our callers, I want to bring up a part of the story with a Wisconsin connection. Republicans in seven states that Biden ultimately won had their electors get together and cast ballots. Two of those states, they made them conditional. Like, yeah, we're not the electors unless court rulings determine that Donald Trump won. Five states, including Wisconsin, didn't have that condition. They just said, we're the electors. There are talks of investigation over signing a fraudulent document here. How important is this part of the story?
I think it's an important part of the story, not necessarily from the legal aspect, and I'm not expert enough to speak to the actual legality of what may or may not have been crossing a law line. But the fact that we have people throughout multiple states who are operating in the same way, following the same pattern, doing the same actions to try to use the same deception, that certainly meets the common sense theory of common sense definition of conspiracy. And to go back to an earlier point that I think one of your callers made, it is absolutely true, thankfully, that President Trump and his efforts to subvert the national will in this election did not work. And one might ask, well, if it didn't work, what's the harm? No harm, no foul, right? So I think we should remind ourselves that, you know, look at this in a different context. If you are planning to rob a bank and begin to try to rob a bank and you get foiled in robbing the bank, you don't walk away scot-free. You know, that's still an illegal act.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Hadi is with us in Madison. Hadi, hi.
Yeah, hi. I like the example your guest just gave. You don't get out of jail because you didn't succeed. That's crazy talk. What I wanted to ask the guest is, can you explain to me how in this world we are not all in the street after what we are seeing? It's impossible that everybody's sitting on his hands, oh, okay, yeah, let's see what happens. This is crazy. in the United States, you have a president trying to steal and make a coup. That, let's call it what it is. It's a coup, attempted coup.
Thanks for the call. Jeff Huddy sees this as a coup. Surprised that the United States, Americans are taking it so calmly.
You know, let me give a counterfactual word of opportunity for people to relax in one sense. As I've said, this is a terrible situation that's going on, but I do think it's important to recognize it could be worse. So right now we have somewhere, depending on your poll, between 50 and 70% of people who declare themselves to be Republicans stating that they believe that the last election was inappropriate, that the last election had some malfeasance, that the last election was in some way not true. We have a smaller percentage who don't believe that Joe Biden is the lawful president, but still almost a majority of Republicans who say that. I would suggest that if Republicans really did think that the wrong person was in jail, they would be in the streets. That if Republican legislators through up and down the party, going all the way up through the Senate and the House, really did think that the wrong person was in the White House, that they would be saying much more and doing much more and arguing much more to not thwart the Democratic agenda in Congress, but rather to thwart the fact that there is a undemocratically elected president. So I think this is a moment where, yes, there are true believers out there. There's no doubt about it. I think President Trump certainly surrounds himself with them. And we've seen that only a few thousand people, as we saw on January 6th, of true believers can cause tremendous mayhem and damage. But I think that the polls that are telling us how many Republicans genuinely believe this stuff are actually not telling us quite the truth. Republicans are saying one thing, but not acting with their feet to demonstrate the other.
Thanks for that call. Go next to Bob in Milwaukee. Bob, hi.
Hi. Hello.
Yes, you're on the air, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi. Given the last two calls, I'll change up a little bit, but I'll just say this. What concerns me right now is that I think, obviously, there's at least a small group of people who are indeed out in the streets, and they're out in the streets based on lies that are told to them, and they ironically, they think that they're doing the right thing. They couch it in words like we're patriots trying to protect our country, but they're not patriots. They're brown shirts. And we are in 1939 Germany right now. I mean, we just don't know it. And the Germans, by and large, didn't know it when they were in the 30s either. It's what's coming is real bad. If we don't uphold the law, we might as well not have a law. You know, I mean, if you just decide that, hey, the Packers scored 7 and the Vikings scored 23, but we don't like the Vikings, so we're going to say, hey, the Packers won anyway. That's not a game anymore.
Bob, thanks for the call. Jeff, this is a concern I hear often, that what we saw in the run-up to January 6th on January 6th didn't work then, but it was a dress rehearsal for something worse that might come in the future.
That is actually my concern. And to your caller's point, I have great sympathy for the people in the streets who are protesting, that small number who do believe that they are saving democracy. If I thought that democracy was being threatened by a president who was not supposed to be in office, or if President Trump had been successful, in my opinion, in keeping the office when he shouldn't have, I like to think I would be in the streets too. So I'm sympathetic and I appreciate the patriotism they are trying to demonstrate. But I do think that we need to pay very careful attention to the reports that are coming out, the draft documents. Yes, they're draft documents, but they tell us what people around President Trump were thinking and planning and discussing about what to do, seizing the ballot boxes, declaring emergencies, declaring that the president has the power to essentially keep civil order, and the president could actually impose martial law, according to the man who was going to be his national security advisor, actually was his first national security advisor for a few weeks, General Michael Flynn, suggested that President Trump should impose martial law to get his processes done. And frankly, these were last minute haphazard ideas because that most of them were formulated after President Trump had lost the election. I frankly think that if the president had been willing to believe that he was going to lose ahead of time, and the people around him as well, if they had put a lot more thought and a lot more planning into how they were going to do this with months in advance to prep, then we'd have a different story. So we now have years for people to prep for the next opportunity. And as to go back to the earlier caller's point, it's a trite thing to say, but it could not be more true. The fundamental element of American civic life is that it requires good people following the law, period. Without that, we have different problems.
Bob, thanks for the call. And just our last minute and a half or so, Jeff, are there guardrails that you think we could put into place that would help prevent these things?
I think transparency is good. The more that we have open, transparent elections, not elections necessarily that where people find it more difficult to vote, but we can have a better sense of what votes actually look like, would be helpful. But I actually have to say that one surprising change in my mind, surprising to me, of what's happened after the election has been my desire to approve suddenly of the Electoral College and of the diffuse nature of the way that we elect presidents. I had previously argued that the Electoral College was undemocratic, and I think it is. I think it disenfranchises voters who come from particular states and helps voters who come from smaller states in particular to have greater power. But that's a necessary flaw, I think, for what the Electoral College and our diffuse system actually gave us after January 6th, which was an opportunity for individuals to make that right call. The Secretary of State of Georgia and of other states to be able to actually follow the law, not just what their party superiors were telling them. I think we'd have a different scenario if you take the hypothetical that we have a national election, one campaign, one election, one ballot box, if you will, and the person who is in charge of counting the votes actually reports to the President of the United States. I think we would have had a different scenario. So the fact that the Secretary of State of Georgia could rightly say to the President of the United States, "Sir, I don't work for you," is a really important safeguard in itself. So as Congress considers future changes, I do hope that they will keep the diffuse nature of the 50 different elections, even though, as I said, that's not something I would have anticipated myself saying 6 months ago.
Jeff, thanks again for joining us today.
It's good to talk to you. Hope to talk to you on happier circumstances next time.
That's Jeffrey Engel, history professor, founding director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University, with the latest on the 2020 elections. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent continues the series of interviews with Wisconsin mayors. This time it's a visit to La Crosse. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Our neighbors in Minnesota are in the news for giving official fun names to their fleet of snowplows. It's a growing trend. While I was looking up that story, I saw something I missed. Appleton announced their snowplow names a couple weeks ago, and they've got a cool service map, so you can see which plow serves which part of the city. Now, a couple of them are named with famous Appletonians in mind. Willem DeSnow, actor Willem Dafoe, is from Appleton, as he mentioned on Saturday Night Live just last weekend. And there's Magnificent Snowdini, a tribute to Harry Houdini's Appleton roots. One plow is named Clark Gable. I can't find a connection to Appleton there. Fill me in if you know there is one or if I'm missing a pun. There's some science fiction and fantasy in the mix. The Blizzard of Oz, Darth Blader, Truck Rogers, and Snowpiercer. There's some dairy theme, cheese sled, and utterly movable. And don't forget Snowy McSnowface. If your community is named It's Snowplows, I want to snow about it. No, but really, email ideas@wpr.org. Keep on trucking. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, for thousands of parents with very young kids, these past few years have been rough. Jen White shares the stories of those families with kids under the age of 5. Find out how they're dealing with burnout, blame, and now the promise of a vaccine for their children. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now we are entering our third year of the pandemic. During the pandemic, Americans have reported a four-fold increase in things like anxiety and depression. Millions of Americans are grieving a loved one. But even if you aren't anxious or depressed or grieving, the relentless stress of surviving a pandemic can take a toll. You may have trouble focusing and getting stuff done, feel like you're always exhausted no matter how much you sleep, or have a general sense of unhappiness. You may be in something called survival mode. We're talking about burnout, mental stress, and survival mode as we enter the third year of the pandemic, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Was I just talking about you? Have you felt that way lately or sometime over the last few years? Did you find a way out of feeling like that, even as the latest surge came along? How has the pandemic affected your ability to focus, to get things done, to be excited about things and enjoy life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Jennifer Barman is an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the University of Texas McGovern Medical School. She's also a clinical psychologist. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Well, a lot of times when we think of stress or even trauma, we might think of an incident or a short period of time. Can you talk about the effects of this sort of long-term, never quite going away kind of stress that we've seen during this pandemic?
Sure. Like you had just mentioned, you know, we're entering our third year of the pandemic. It's crazy to believe that we have been dealing with this pandemic for as long as we have. Well, it's caused a lot of changes in our lives, of course. And unlike stressors that we may have had at work or at home or at school or in different areas of our life before this, we have not had any respite from it. You know, other stressors that we've had throughout our lives, we get to get a break from it. But here we are, year number three, and we're just dealing with a constant state of having to adapt, having to make decisions about safety, having to deal with all these many little stressors, which add up to a lot of big stressors in our life.
That brings us to this concept of survival mode, which I kind of get the gist from the name, I think, but it was new to me as a psychological concept. What do we mean by survival mode?
Yeah, when we're in survival mode, it just feels like something isn't right. And, you know, when we think back of how we've been doing the past 2 years, probably all of us have in some extent been in survival mode. When we're in survival mode, we might notice that we're just feeling more nervous, more anxious. We feel easily overwhelmed, easily irritated by things. Our mood tends to fluctuate, and we may notice that it takes a little bit longer for us to feel okay in between sad moods. We may feel more frustrated and experience a lot of difficulty with tolerating that distress or that frustration. And it can take a toll on how we're performing at work, at school, in our lives kind of overall. And it takes a toll on our relationships with that. We may notice we're a little bit more snippy when we're in survival mode. It's just harder to be able to be as resilient as we naturally are. And with that comes, you know, changes in our sleep patterns where we might notice that we're sleeping more. We're maybe taking that afternoon nap more frequently than we would have before the pandemic or before being in survival mode. We may notice we're having trouble falling or staying asleep. We could be turning to food to be able to cope with all these emotions that we're experiencing. And we may notice that we feel less pleasure in activities we used to enjoy, and perhaps even less motivation to engage in those activities that we used to find a lot of enjoyment in. And so sometimes when we're in that survival mode, we may get to a point of being in more of a struggle mode or a crisis mode, but not necessarily always the case. Some signs to be on the lookout for are those kind of emotional signs that I was just mentioning, but also physical signs. If you notice, like, you're having a lot more muscle tension, a lot more headaches, stomach aches, low energy, this could be survival mode. And it's really coming from a place of just being in this kind of constant state of stress, constant state of adaptation, feeling really overwhelmed with life in general and safety and all the obligations that come along with life as well as with the pandemic.
Talking to Jennifer Barman, psychologist at the University of Texas McGovern Medical School, looking at this idea of survival mode. A lot of people might have found themselves in during the pandemic. You can share your experiences if these things sound familiar or if you've had ways of getting out of that mode. Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Nick is with us in Green Bay. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Hi. I really enjoy your show. I appreciate it. We're not really stressed out about the COVID thing. We had COVID in August, and I was really sick. The only issue we had was the kids had to go virtual because of the school district, and it was so hard to get them to concentrate. They went from being straight-A students down to being horrible students. And that was a stress. There's a lot of fighting. There's a lot of screaming at the kids, like, come on, you've got to get, you know, into school, and there's no interest in it. I mean, after we got back to go back into school, they're just like, thank you so much for getting back into school, like non-virtually. And I don't really like the virtual thing. I think it's very impersonal. So that's the only issue we've had since we went back to school. Life's been great. I mean, we're not too concerned about COVID now.
Nick, glad to hear they're doing better back at school. But that disruption of routine, the thing we're used to, the mode in this case of learning that we're used to, it isn't just the disease itself, but the disruptions it caused. Can you talk about the kind of problems, Jennifer, that can cause?
Yes, absolutely. So even if we're not necessarily concerned about getting sick, you know, we've been vaccinated or we've gotten sick in the past, the pandemic can still take a toll on our overall well-being. In this case, as Nick, you were just sharing, we're worried about our kiddos. The work from home, school from home, virtual learning, that's been a huge transition for families. You may be worrying, are your kids getting the education that they need? Are they getting the social development that they need? And how do we as adults best model healthy habits for our kids? So I can definitely understand your concern there, Nick. It's definitely tough during this time, this unprecedented time in our lives.
Thanks for calling in, Nick, at 800-642-1234. Cole joins us next in Stevens Point. Cole, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I definitely connect with everything that Jennifer's been sharing, and I think for me, one of the most helpful things has been just getting outside more, which has been more difficult in the wintertime. But I guess I was wondering Jennifer's thoughts on the benefits of just getting outside more.
Cole, thanks for the call. It's a great idea. I think something that's probably helped a lot of people, Jennifer.
Yes, self-care, self-care, self-care. This is number one. And going outside is a terrific way to engage in self-care, especially if the weather's nice, or even if it's not so nice, but going out for a little walk, going out and just spending some time outside. What that can do is it gives us a lot of good feelings. And, you know, we know that exercise or even, as I said, just spending time outside, it can help with our mental health. It can help us combat some of those blues that we might be noticing during feelings of being in survival mode. So I'm really glad that you're getting out of the house a little bit more. But self-care, whether that's spending time outdoors, doing something that you really enjoy doing, spending time with others, those can all be very helpful ways to combat some of this emotional distress or emotional difficulty that you might be experiencing.
Cole, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And thanks for bringing us into some of the solution side of things here. One thing that strikes me, Jennifer, is, you know, if you're one person and you're in the midst of this multi-year global pandemic, it seems like part of the problem has got to be the sense that there's a lot that's out of your control. Are there ways that we can carve out a little bit of control in our lives that are going to help us get out of this survival mode?
Absolutely. You know, checking in with yourself, each person knows what their own limits are. Know those limits. It's okay to say no to things if you're feeling overwhelmed. It's okay to put up some boundaries as well. So even when you're alone, how can you kind of manage that stress? Are there ways that you've managed stress in other areas of your life, at other times of your life? Those will probably be helpful here. And I realize that with the pandemic, it's caused a disruption in how we can function and how we can access and use our coping skills most effectively. But sometimes our coping skills are still there, such as, you know, our last caller just mentioned about getting outside of the house. That's a really terrific way to use those coping strategies to take care of oneself more effectively. In terms of getting control over our life, engaging in those activities can be really helpful. Also recognizing what are some areas of your life that you still have control over. We all feel like we've lost a lot of control during the pandemic, right? There's mask mandates, there's all sorts of things that maybe we feel all sorts of feelings about. But what are some areas of your life that you still have control over? And we want to capitalize on those areas. We want to really acknowledge that they exist and best utilize those.
Thanks again for that call. We're talking to Jennifer Barman, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the University of Texas McGovern Medical School. She's talking to us about stress, burnout, and pandemic survival mode, what it is, and maybe how to get out of it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How has the pandemic affected things that were maybe already tough, like parenting, going through a breakup, grieving, losing a job, having a chronic illness? Have you felt that sort of just sustained blah through this thing? Have you found ways to get out of it, to de-stress during the pandemic, get out of survival mode? Do you have recommendations to share with others? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Jennifer Barman, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the University of Texas McGovern Medical School, talking to us about how to get out of survival mode and what survival mode is as we enter the third year of this ongoing pandemic. You could join in with your experiences, your questions, your solutions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Mike is with us in Rusk County. Mike, hi.
Hi. When the whole COVID thing first started, I felt a little bit of stress, I have to admit. But I'll tell you, I have full faith and confidence in our medical community and our technology that's out there with the vaccines and so forth. And once I got the vaccine, and then when the boosters are required, once I got the booster, I didn't look back. I have total faith and comfort. I go out and live my life pretty much the way I lived it before the COVID. And I don't feel any stress at all now.
Mike, thanks. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Mike. And I think a lot of people if you graphed their stress out, Jennifer, for a lot of people, they were like Mike, where the stress level may have gone down a lot after those vaccines started getting in, as people started to get them. And maybe if we worry about the news lately, it's good to reflect on the progress that's been made compared to where we were maybe a year or two ago.
For sure. A year or two ago, things looked very different. So even though we're entering the third year of the pandemic, we have the vaccinations to rely on, the medicine and the science that went behind it. But I can also understand for some people that while all this is out there and we are accessing and utilizing all this wonderful science, that it can still feel a little confusing at times. I look back at last spring when vaccinations were becoming more widespread and there was a return to some resemblance of the pre-pandemic life. But then Delta happened, and then Omicron happened. And we may at times still be feeling very much the effects of the surge and the effects of the pandemic. It's wonderful to hear that some people are not feeling stressed, and that's fantastic, and that's what we want to hear. But it's okay if that's also not the case.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. I want to get into another concept comes up in conjunction with survival mode, the idea of cognitive dulling. What is that? What does that mean?
Yeah, so cognitive dulling is nothing new. It's something you might have experienced after a sleepless night or when you're not feeling well or when you're feeling very stressed. But what's unusual about cognitive dulling now is that how pervasive it is. And what cognitive dulling really is, it's a form of mental fatigue that can impact concentration, it can impact focus, attention, productivity, and overall emotional well-being and mental health. So it's something that we're seeing and hearing a lot more as having occurred in the past couple of years with the COVID-19 pandemic. And a lot of it has to do with this being in a constant state of adaptation and tying back to that survival mode. So being in that survival mode can trigger that sensation of cognitive dulling. We've had to make so many changes in the past couple of years, and we're continuing to having to adapt even now. We're dealing with poor boundaries of time. We're dealing with our kiddos being home. We're dealing with maybe being apart from our loved ones. And so it can affect how we function most effectively.
Talking to Jennifer Barman from the University of Texas McGovern Medical School, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences there, looking at some of the mental health, emotional health impacts of the ongoing pandemic. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234, but mostly talking about people who have just been kind of living through the pandemic. How about people for whom the pandemic has been what we might call traumatic? Somebody who's lost close loved ones, maybe multiple close loved ones, or the healthcare worker who has seen this, the worst parts of the surges. What kind of things can we think about to help get them through not just the ongoing pandemic, but this acute kind of trauma that they're seeing?
Yes, it's been a very difficult time for a lot of people. You mentioned healthcare workers, and also you mentioned people who lost a loved one. Now, having lost loved ones, that can be particularly challenging in these really unprecedented times, because there's a lot of things that go with it. It's this emotional processing that we're having to deal with, along with maybe being apart from others who we could maybe turn to for support and for help with the coping process. So giving ourselves that the recognition that it's okay to still be grieving, and it's okay to perhaps be grieving a little bit longer than we may have pre-pandemic. And for healthcare workers, it's so important that those tools that help with the stress, that we turn to those, but that we also turn to others. So for everyone, whether healthcare workers, first responders, civilians, people out there who are our listeners today, asking for help. We all have been going through a lot these past 3 years, and even if our stress feels like it's a lot more manageable now, know that sometimes being in that survival mode can also trigger a little bit more of that struggle mode or even crisis. And there are resources out there. So turning to people for help and support is going to be really essential here. And whether that's a loved one that we can turn to or the professionals, there are resources available.
Let's go back to our callers now. Joe is with us in Waukesha. Joe, hi.
Hello. Yeah, I just wanted to just a quick comment. During the pandemic, you know, I was extremely stressed at my job because we made like, you know, automation for like warehouses to, you know, for people that bought more stuff online to get things out quicker. And we never closed during the pandemic, quite the opposite. You know, we were working 70 hour weeks because we just had a bunch of orders. And I was there for like over a decade, and it just became over, like, you know, way too much for me. And I just found another job that was just a lot less stressful because it was just the expectations were just way, way too high. And just thank you.
Joe, thank you so much for sharing that story. You are not alone there. A lot of people switching jobs over the last couple of years. Jennifer, a lot of people in that situation, maybe rethinking what their job is and should be, as Joe did.
Yes, we definitely are seeing that a lot across the board here. And there's a lot of factors that go with that. Exhaustion, burnout, working those 60, 70 hours a week, that's a lot. But also satisfaction in work. It has definitely shifted for many people. And then there's people who lost their jobs during the COVID pandemic, particularly when I'm thinking like early pandemic, when there were a lot of losses, where there were transitions to other formats. It's tough. It's tough to have to reconsider what you want your career to look like or find a new job. Sometimes, as you know, our colleague was just mentioning, you've been in this organization for a decade, for a long period of time in your life, and it's tough making those transitions, whether it's with the goal of finding more life satisfaction, better work-life balance, or for other reasons.
Joe, thanks again for sharing your story. Time for one more caller. Wanda is with us in Orfordville. Wanda, hello.
Hello. I just want to share my happy experience with being sequestered. And it was the first winter of sequestering. A little kitten was dropped apparently from heaven into my yard in mid-November and gave me something warm to touch and love all the time I was sequestered.
Wanda, what's your kitten's name?
Bibsy Snowfoot.
Okay. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think a lot of people, Jennifer, turned to pets, kittens or otherwise during this.
Definitely. It goes back to that self-care, that companionship, that the warm and fuzzies that we get from turning to our pets. They are a huge source of support. And a lot of people have turned to adopting more pets during this time. One thing about the work from home situation that a lot of people transition to is you have more accessibility to be able to tend to your pets day long. And so that's one of the wonderful things about self-care. And it sounds like a great way to do self-care.
Thanks for the call, Wanda. Just in our last half a minute or so, Jennifer, can you leave us with some encouragement if we're spotting some of these symptoms of survival mode you laid out earlier?
Yes, absolutely. Know that this is a current status that we're in. And you know, it feels like it's been unrelenting and going on forever, but it will get better. And during these times when maybe it's a little bit darker and harder to see those good times, know that there are a lot of good things still that you can maybe turn to and a lot of support out there. As I was mentioning that talking to others or turning to support, I just wanna highlight the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline and text line. That's 1-800-273-8255, or the text line is texting home to 741741. And there's other crisis lines as well for that are accessible to you. Turn to those resources, turn to our loved ones, turn to people in your environment, ask for help because you are not alone.
Thanks to our guest, Jennifer Barman, assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the University of Texas McGovern Medical School, talking about our mental and emotional well-being during the pandemic. Tomorrow on Central Time, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll find out ways to plan ahead with recipes we can make and freeze. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we're going to hear about your favorite games, puzzles, and brain teasers. Maybe it's Wordle, Jumble, Words with Friends, Scrabble, Sudoku. Tell us why you play and why others should too. You can let us know right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Barrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.